This is the QSL Radio Show, and you're listening to a rebroadcast of Dayton 2012 as it was broadcast live on international shortwave and streaming audio. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either, there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. This is the QSO Radio Show. And now, back to our broadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2012.
Both histogramically in the audio spectrum in real time, and you can watch it as in time at the same time, so you can look for that classic Christmas tree that you want to get the best crest factor signal to noise when you're talking, trying to drive your amplifier. It's all right there in front of you so you can see it and adjust it. The ESSB crowd love our Flex radios. The AMers love our Flex radios because, for instance, on the Flex 5000, you can go out to plus and minus 10 kilohertz on AM. And there are guys that like to do that, to like to run full fidelity AM, or they like to run ESSB sideband. And we love to be able to support them. Our new radio, of course, does the same and more.
What about the final section on these radios? How is that done? I mean, how is it any different than any of the...
The only thing that's really different, I mean, these are radios with real filters. For instance, our new 6000 series has complete half-band filters all the way through the ham bands. But what you'll notice about it is there's just less stuff. Why? Because we're directly driving the pre-drivers right out of the digital section. In the case of the 6000, it's a direct up conversion. So when you hit the CW key, we're generating the exact frequency, including wave shaping and envelope shaping and everything else right on frequency. In the case of the 3000, 5000, and 1500, what we're doing is we actually generate a thing called a quadrature sampling exciter, and we actually we run through the QSE, then make RF, then we go right to the pre-drivers. So there's not a lot of stages in our transmit section. Our finals are all FET-based, classic push-pull design, very, very linear. They're not Class A. All of our drivers are Class A. Why? Because all the software is Class A. So really, the only time we have to drop into Class AB type world is at the very end of the rainbow.
Just out of curiosity, I was just checking email here. A listener in Wyoming is asking on the CW, if you're operating CW and you narrow the bandpass down, can you adjust the window, I guess is what they're saying. In other words, can you set the tone as to where the CW signal's coming in is what he's asking.
Yeah.
I know what he's he's asking. I just don't know exactly how to word it.
No, it's a great question, because one of the things that Flex Radio is known for is the ability to do amazingly narrow filters. For instance, it's no big deal to run a 20 hertz CW filter and with no ringing. Why? Well, you can just set software up so its software won't ring. It's pretty straightforward. But there are people that want to run at 600 hertz. There are people who want to run at 700 hertz. Some people like to run at 400 hertz. Again, it has a lot to do with the sonic perception of what they want to hear for their side tone, or out on the other, you know, out on the transmit side. And yeah, all that's definitely programmable and adjustable on the fly.
Well, I was wondering, reading that, because now here's a person that has, they're grasping some of this that we're talking about, but Flex is a total unknown quantity to them. They see maybe see an ad somewhere, but they don't quite understand it. They don't quite connect as to what exactly this is. And I was thinking, so in other words, if you want to hear the CW signal coming in, let's say you want to hear it at 800 hertz to your ears, you can vary controls on the Flex to narrow it down as narrow as you want, and also vary the pitch of the tone to where that CW signal is one note coming in at 800 hertz where your ear wants to hear it.
Right. So what you'll do is on the receive side, you simply just adjust what you perceive as the frequency, if you will, to get the right tone. And then you adjust the filter. You basically move the signal into the passband of the filter and then adjust them to be as narrow as you want them to be. Some people don't like narrow filters because it makes the tone sound choppy. Well, the coolest thing, we've actually found out that with our new tracking notch filters, you can actually stack tracking notch filters on each side of the CW tone and create your own wave shaping in addition to the receive EQ. So if you've got a regular SCED and you like to run CW with guys, you can literally start stacking soft filters on these sides and create your own edge gradients.
One of the weirdest things I ever saw was a guy that ran his receiver in through a reverb. And when he listened to CW, he had just a touch of reverb on it, you know. And I thought, I don't know what the hell that was. What it reminded me of, though, I remember when I went to take the general test in Detroit, being at the Federal Building in this big, big marble and glass edifice, and the ceilings were like, I don't know. But, so the guy, and the code generation machine, I used the thing that ran tape through it, you know, and it was at the front of the room, and I was in the very back. So I got all the reverb I could stand on that CW, you know. Still passed, but it was just, it reminded me of that. I thought, why would somebody want to do that, you know? But
you just gave away your age, by the way, because all of us who have ever taken a test at the FCC, we all remember that.
Yeah, well, you know, the other part you probably remember, too, and that is this, the examiner. Incidentally, VK1, I don't know if it's AX or TX, I can't remember, in Australia says, hello? I, too, love the Flex Radio. Well, I guess it's coming in off
of... Yeah, we have a lot of customers down under, so to speak, or up above, whichever way they want to look at it. Yeah.
But did you ever notice this? Now, here's what they did. This was for the commercial license as well as the amateur license. The FCC examiner, if you had failed the test, he would call your name out to the entire group of people, and he would say, Greg, you have failed, okay? You know, and of course, you would just want to crawl under a table somewhere, you know. But now, if you pass the test, he'd call you to the front. He'd say, could you come up here for a second, Greg? I need to speak to you for just a second. And you'd come up, and he would very quietly say, Greg, you've passed. Now, why did they do that? I mean, I remember that because I was just dreading. I never failed one, but I dreaded it because they could see when they would call the person's name out. And before they either said, come up to the front, or I made the announcement, you could watch the person just cringe, you know. And then if they said, you have failed, you could watch them just die right in their seat, you know. So, but anyway, how about giving away? Well, tell me about the Flex Radio website, how folks can get a hold of you, how they can look at these radios. And we'll have to have you back on the show again, too, because I know there's pockets of these guys that have these radios it's become almost like a religious cult, you know.
I'm glad you said that.
once they get a Flex radio, it's like they've changed, you know. I mean, you can't even talk anything else to them, because they're totally keyed to this. Now, you guys have had events here at Dayton.
Yes, and we actually are going to have another one tonight. We do our annual Flex banquet. We have a user group, basically, that meets every year. We've got 130 or 40 people showing up tonight for dinner downtown Dayton at one of the hotels. And it's great. I believe we're close to being sold out. If someone happens to be listening here at Dayton, stop by the Flex booth, 316. Actually, we've got a whole bunch of them, but that's the easy number to remember in the Ball Arena. The best way to learn about our radios is to check out our website, www.flexradio.com. For instance, on the brand new Flex 6000 series, we've actually generated a eight-page technical briefing on the technology behind the new Flex Signature Series 6000 radios. So we're real excited about that. Also, our 1500, 3000, and 5000, all the data sheets are online, and there is a host of YouTube videos that we've got linked from our website, obviously, to YouTube, to see the Flex radio in operation.
Very, very cool. Yeah, because I know I ran into a couple fellas that said, I'm going to the Flex thing tonight. I've got to go, you know, because we were out doing different things, you know, and they were like wired, you know. I'm going to go to the Flex thing tonight, you know. I think you guys have such a strong users group base of people that once they get their feet wet in this radio, they're wanting to share what they know to other people and get into discussions. And I think, you know, it's like you said, somebody comes up with a better noise blanker, you know, out of the users group, for goodness sake. That's amazing. It really is. I mean, what a technology, you know.
Well, unfortunately, I need to get back to the booth.
Yes, I know.
Hold that down. Thank you so much for allowing me. No, that's fine. And thanks, guys, for letting me join in today. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you coming by here, because it's good to hear about new technology and all these things that we don't necessarily understand. Okay, with us also, I've got Tim over here. I didn't want you to run off, because I still wanted to talk about the lightning situation, because we hadn't really covered a whole lot of that. I've got people coming and going. And this other gentleman just sat down here. Why don't you tell us who you are and what you do?
Hi, I'm Thomas Witherspoon. I'm the founder and director of Ears to Our World, which is a 501c3 charity that works in developing countries.
And what is it that you... what is Ears to the World?
Well, we believe that access to information is access to education. So what we believe is that if people have... We work in places where they don't have the internet, they don't have electricity, and people forget that fully one quarter of humanity does not have access to electricity or the power grid. So our way of working is not through the internet or laptops or anything. We try to use an appropriate technology, which is shortwave radio.
And we don't know what that is.
Isn't that grandpa's technology? You probably don't know what it is, do you? Yeah, that's right. You're a figure in shortwave radio.
Well, you know what? What's very strange is I came across... I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because it bears repeating. And I'll try to make it quick. I ran across a published article that said the Texon Radio Company in Beijing manufactures 30,000 multiband radios per day. And I said, it's got to be a misprint, but I would like to know how many they actually do manufacture. Because there's all this talk. Internet, we're talking about internet, we're talking about smartphones, we're talking about all this technology, okay? And then somebody says shortwave, and people go, you know, like that. You know, I'm like, but they don't get it. They don't get it. I get a hold of the folks at Texon. I said, that's got to be a misprint. The guy says, oh, no, not a misprint. I said, you make 30,000 multiband radios a day. He said, yeah. I said, where do they go? You know, what do you do with that many radios in a day? How do you, I mean, not a little manufacturer, but I mean, I would think that after 5 or 6 days, boy, you'd have a pile of radios sitting there. You know, where do they go? He said, well, every Radio Shack store in the United States of America stocks 4 or 5 models of multiband shortwave radios. He said they have stocked them since the inception of Radio Shack. They've had extensive shortwave radios. I guess maybe not what you'd consider to be the old Radio Shack that stocked tube shortwave radios, but I'm talking about multi-band portables. They've gone through all their changes. They decided to call themselves the Shack and do nothing but cell phones and all that stuff. And now they're back to restocking their stores of electronic parts. But through all of that, they dropped carrying ham equipment. They don't carry any amateur equipment at all. But they still carry multi-band shortwave radios. Now, Texon makes the Grundig. They make the Eaton. Is it the Kaito?
Kaito.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. They make that. They make all those. The only thing they don't make is Sony. So I'm talking to him, and I'm absorbing this because I'm thinking, even the smallest little bitty city that has a Radio Shack is going to have two or three multi-band radios, and in the big towns you're going to have 7-8 models that they carry. And this has been consistent. So somebody's buying them, or Radio Shack would not stock them in the stores. And they just wouldn't be a stock item. So, okay. I'm hearing this, and it's going through my head, and I'm thinking to myself, yeah, this is something I really had never thought about. And that explains the sizable audience that we have stateside, because we get literally hundreds and hundreds of emails off of QSO, which means we've got that many people listening inside the United States. Then the fella told me something that just kind of blew me away. He said, only one-third of China is on the power grid. Two-thirds is not. So that means that all these people that claim they're reaching into China by means of satellite television and all these higher modes of technology, it ain't happening. The staple over there is the portable, battery-operated or crank-up multi-band radio. So I that struck home to me. And then I realized that explains, and he said this also holds true with Africa, India, and big portions of Russia. And then what was really strange, he said the economy in China is changing radically. He said you may have, you know, people living in an area that they may have a brand new car sitting in the driveway, but they don't have power because the government has just not been able to put power out into that part of the country yet. They may not be totally flat economically depressed, but they still don't have any access to outside information because the only thing they have is a portable shortwave radio. And then we have people like our government shutting down Voice of America, which makes absolutely no sense. But, you know, but go ahead. I've said enough. You know.
Well, I mean, you know, you make a really good point. The great thing about shortwave radio is it has no regard for borders. You know, the internet, international broadcasters are pulling out of shortwave in many countries. And in countries like China, they say, well, you know, so much of China has the internet. But what they don't think about is China also blocks the internet extensively.
Oh, yeah, the ports are blocked for all kinds of things.
Absolutely.
Very few, you know.
And you can't, you can't look at the Voice of America Chinese in China. So what, you know, the IBB, or I should say the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is the governing body over all U.S. international broadcasting, they've been investing in these technologies to circumvent the firewall. They call it the Great Firewall of China. But what they don't think about is, you know, on the other end, the person that would be looking at a site circumventing Chinese firewalls, what kind of danger are they in when they're reading something they know they shouldn't be reading? Whereas with a radio, there's no way to trace it. It's something you can listen to in your car, you can listen to it at home, you can listen to it anywhere you want to. And unless someone hears you listening to it, there's no way to trace you, there's no way to track you. And shortwave radio doesn't care where you live. It's always there.
That goes across government barriers. The other thing, too, that we've noticed, and that is this, we've gotten emails where people are saying that in North Korea, they hide radios in their houses.
Oh, yeah.
The government, if they find out that you've got a radio that will receive an unauthorized frequency, it's a serious offense. I don't know what the consequences are, but, I mean, I guess they probably lock you up or kill you or something. I don't know. So it's hard to believe that inside of a country like even North Korea that people have multi-band shortwave radios. And folks from Texon were telling me this. They have places in their homes specifically to hide these things when no one. So what now? What is it that you folks do? Now we've all went around the Christmas tree. What is your
well, specifically what we do is we distribute self-powered radios, the crank-up kind, made by Eaton Corporation, who is an incredible donor of radios to us. They've donated literally hundreds and hundreds of radios to us for educational purposes. And we take those to teachers in countries like South Sudan. We work really extensively in a few communities in South Sudan where they have no electricity. They have no infrastructure, frankly. They're in a very war-torn area. And we make a partnership with each teacher where we say, if you take care of this radio and use it in the classroom and use it at home and just learn about the world around you and take that into the classroom, we'll take care of your radio over time. So if you keep your radio, we come back next year and we'll replace out your radio if it's broken or if it needs fixing or it needs a new rechargeable battery pack in it. And by doing this, the teachers have a vested interest in taking care of it. They know they're a partner. They're not just a recipient of something that falls from the sky, which is what happens a lot in developing countries with aid programs. And so, you know, it's been very successful. The impact of one radio is amazing. I've got pictures of kids, of like 30 kids listening to one radio program. And that's something you can't do on the internet very easily. It's hard to share an internet experience with one computer, you know, with one mobile phone.
Now, what stations or programming are they listening to?
They're listening to, you know, I was interviewed by Voice of America, it's probably 2 years ago now, and they asked me that same question. And they said, you know, for example, in South Sudan, what do they listen to? And she was really taken back when I told her that they listen to Voice of America. In fact, they listen to Voice of America's Special English. In South Sudan, their new official language is English, which kind of ties together all the other regional dialects. And they all use it for business purposes and for government purposes. Well, Voice of America's Special English is a program that speaks at about two-thirds normal cadence when you're speaking. In fact, in the interview, it was for Special English, and it was very difficult to slow down your speed two-thirds. And they use a core vocabulary of 1,400 words. And what that means is they simplify all the news, and they simplify small documentaries, and they read them over the air. And if you have a textbook understanding of English, you can understand the program, and it builds your English skills very quickly.
Well, you know, when I talked to the fellow from Texan, I said, in the programming that we're doing, should we be doing this in Mandarin, or should we be doing it in Cantonese? And he said, no. He said, do it in English. And I was like, why? He said, it's a second language here, and everybody wants to learn English. They want to learn better English. They want to learn it more fluently. And so I've listened to VOA and their special English broadcast. Actually, when you're listening to it, you don't really notice it that much. But if you really examine it, you can tell they are talking slower, and they're using fewer words, and the words that they do use are basic staple words inside the English language. You don't hear a lot of big words, multi-syllable words that people wouldn't understand. And but really, when you get right down to it, I don't know, in the United States of America, people who write copy for national commercials learned a long time ago if they want to sell product, they've got to hit at about the eighth grade level. Okay. And I don't know what the special English is, if that's what grade level they say it is. I don't recall. At some point in time I've heard it. But what struck me was it isn't any different than the commercials that are being written to sell products, because we know here in our country, even though people speak English, some folks don't necessarily understand it, you know. So, well, how do folks get involved with your organization?
Well, we have a website, which is earstoourworld.org. Actually, we have you can use the acronym ETOW.org. That's a very easy way to get in touch with us. We have a contact page there. We have quite a lot of ham radio operators. I'm a ham radio operator to K4SWL, and we have a lot of ham radio operators who do volunteer work for us and that also donate. You know, we're 501c3, so everything's tax deductible. And, you know, when you're talking about broadcasters, international broadcasters, you know, I guess you'd say I'm a radio evangelist of a different stripe. I believe that international broadcasting, I understand that they need to trim down some of their shortwave offerings. You know, RNW, Radio Netherlands, just cut their Dutch broadcasts. But it was mainly for expatriates, and Dutch expatriates nowadays really don't listen to Dutch programming over shortwave a lot. But at least they're keeping a lot of their programming to these parts of the world that really need it. And Radio Canada International just cut their shortwave. And I like to see what Voice of America has done recently. It was actually rededicated their site in Greenville, North Carolina. It's now called the Edward R. Murrow Transmitting Site. And they've sort of reaffirmed that they have an interest in having an international broadcasting station on American soil. It's like the one thing we can do, we can control our content that comes out of that station. We can't do that in other parts of the world where we have transmission sites. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's a great way to get in touch with us, and please contact us if you got any questions. And we're here at the Dayton Hamvention in the East Hall, booth 601.
I don't know if it's open to the public, but the Bethany, Ohio VOA site here, the local amateur club took that thing over, and they have preserved, I think, one 250,000-watt transmitter, or at least a good portion of it. The antenna changing station outside, I think of course, all the rest of it's gone. But none of that made any sense to me at all, and that is to take a perfectly good operation, especially like in Delano, California, and just do away with these things. I mean, it's just insanity, you know. And I think there are some political reasons as to why those particular Voice of America installations were wanted gone by certain government officials. I really believe that. I mean, I'll always believe that. Because what a calling card. What a calling card. You've got, and that was the one thing the guy from Texan asked me the question, and he spoke very good English with a Chinese accent. He says, "Do you have any idea how many people are in China?" You know, and I thought about it. That's a lot of folks over there, you know. What a beautiful calling card to be able to present to those people things about our culture, who we are, what we do, our history and whatnot, things that maybe they want to hear. Now, I do know, for example, Radio China International has a 250,000-watt transmitter sitting down in South America pointed right at us and Canada. They're serious about us knowing who they are. Why, then, is our government not serious about telling them who we are, is the question. And I'm saying this on two international shortwave stations right now. So, I mean, as far as I know, we are on 9990 WTWW out of Tennessee, which is just outside of Lebanon, Tennessee. And also, we're on 9330 WBCQ out of Monticello, Maine, Alan Weiner Station, both of which I consider to be fantastic radio outlets. Alan is a genius, and so is George McClintock, too. Very unusual people who have extreme talents.
And this is a good point. I was just at the North American Shortwave Broadcasters meeting in D.C. last week. These are primarily private broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing is, in all of these cuts to international broadcasting, really what's happened is international broadcasters like the Voice of America, BBC World Service, a lot of their facilities were created in the Cold War when we didn't care how much money it costs to make a station. I just toured the VOA site, the new site, the new rededicated site in Greenville, North Carolina. It's on 2,800 acres. It's amazing. Their antenna farm's amazing. Amazing people who work there. And I was just floored by the enormity of this place. And I said, "Wow, this must be like the biggest site you guys have had." And he said, "Well, I mean, there was the VOA site A, 18 miles away." And I said, "How similar was it?" He said, "It was identical down to where the water fountains are placed in our building. It was a redundant site on a separate power grid." I mean, it was amazing. But private broadcasters have a way of doing this efficiently and keeping their station alive. And I really feel like there could be a way that we could share resources, you know, across borders, and broadcasters could stay in the international shortwave business if they were using private broadcasters in their mix as well.
Well, see, a lot of folks will ask a question. They'll say, well, why do I hear so much religion on shortwave? Okay. Well, you have ministries that are willing to pay for the airtime, and the electric bill on one single transmitter is close to $12,000 a month. Okay, so in other words, you've got to have something on the air that's relatively serious. And the other thing that I find absolutely amazing, and that is people who have used shortwave radio for advertising have sold tons of product over the air. It's one of the most, I think it's the secret weapon, you know. I mean, if I were to go on to advertise and marketing products, I'd go on shortwave, because I think what happened on AM and FM is people are just hypnotized. They don't listen to anything anymore, you know. And at least on shortwave, you can do like what we're doing right now. Talk as much as you want, say as much as you want. And there's a lot of people, but the people that are out there listening are actually listening.
Yes.
They're not ignoring it. We are not background noise in someone's house. Well, we could be, but I'm just saying, for the most part, we're not background noise, you know.
And when international broadcasters that have been on shortwave turn to the internet and think that's going to be their magic for going forward, what they don't realize is they're joining 1,500 billion people who are also broadcasting. All of a sudden, they're in a saturated market where the religious broadcasters understand they're in a market, and I've talked to some, they're in a market where their competitors are going away. So their voice is even stronger.
Oh, yeah.
And they know there are listeners, and that's why they stay in the business.
Yeah, and you'll hear some of the, I would say, ministries that come on the air on shortwave. And some of them are just, how would I want to say it? They're very challenged in terms of their presentation, their audio, their manner of speaking, the voice. Everything about them is compromised, but yet they have a following and they have strong supporters. So what that says to me is the media is strong. That medium of shortwave is extremely strong. You know? So, but I appreciate you coming by here, and I'm glad you've passed the information on, and we'll have to stay in contact and do this again sometime.
Please do. Thanks a lot.
And appreciate you coming by Dayton here. We're broadcasting from Dayton, and this is the Dayton Hamvention, 2012.
You're listening to the QSO Radio Show, brought to you by Ham Test Online and Transworld Antennas. And now your host, with the only wolf hung in the Southeast United States, very few people know that, Ted Randall.
And we are live. Dayton, Ohio, once again brought to you by the folks at Ham Test Online. I want to talk about them just for a moment, and that is that let you know that if you are thinking about getting a ham ticket, I'm the easiest route to go. I mean, the most painless and the most interesting way to go about getting that ham ticket is by utilizing Ham Test Online. And I got a gentleman sitting here that's, I haven't introduced you, but we've got a lot of company here. This guy he's with RF Finder, but it's Bob Greenberg. Now, you say your son passed with Ham Test
Online? Yeah, my son, when he was 9 years old, passed his tech using Ham Test Online. And then when he turned 10, right after he turned 10, he did his general on Ham Test Online also. So that was pretty fun. And my programmer, Jesse, he just, KE2BTQ, just got his tech ticket using Ham Test Online also. So it's been great.
So many people that we know, I mean, so many folks I know, have used Ham Test Online, and it's very reasonable. I think for the tech, it's like $20. You get a 2-year subscription, and you study, and the questions are programmed in such a way, and you learn. You actually learn. This isn't like a crash course. You know, it's a
bargain at any price, Ted.
You know, yeah, for a person to get there. And we're going to talk about your app in a minute, but one thing I did want to bring back up, because I've got a bunch of emails that come in from people asking questions, and they said, can you explain how this lightning system works? With me is Tim, and Tim, I want you to talk about, this is called, the name of the product is SensorGuard. And SensorGuard is a very unusual lightning protection product. This is not like anything that you've seen before. This is not a lightning arrestor. It's not a surge protector. It's very kind of difficult to describe, but I'll give the nutshell thing here just as quick as I can, and then you can expound on it. And that is, this is something that senses a strike before the strike takes place, and at within seconds of the lightning strike, disconnects your equipment from the power line, allows the lightning discharge to take place, or the surge, or whatever it is that's coming down the pike, and then puts your equipment back on the power line and does it just split seconds. So, you know, you don't have to. And one of the most aggravating things to me is, you know, being away from home and having to call the house and say, hey, will somebody go in and unplug all my equipment, please? I'd appreciate it. Disconnect the antenna, put it outside, you know, whatever. And you forget to do that. And the other thing is that the majority of the lightning strikes that come in that damage equipment come in through the power grid. They don't come in through your antenna, most of them. And you heard the fellow from Flex Radio was sitting here. And he said most of them come in through the power lines of this thing. So tell us a little bit again how the system works and how you all came about creating this thing and how you wound up here at Dayton.
I'm glad to, Ted. We're glad to be here. It's quite an event. I'm learning the ham industry as we go here. Been a couple of events now, and so we're looking at the marketing aspects of the ham guys out there, and I'm amazed at what they know and what they do. It just simply amazes me. And so basically our SensorGuard product was invented by a fellow in St. Paul, Nebraska, and he just back in 1982 when he actually started working with this, he was asked by an elevator operator, a grain elevator operator, about developing something to protect the load cells on their scales. And so he started thinking about that and finally come up with SensorGuard, what you see today, and has refined it and updated the technology and all of that as well. But that's how it started out. Started out in the heartland out there in the corn country. And that's where it came from. So basically, you were right, Ted. I mean, you've got a handle on the product maybe better than I do. But what we do is we isolate you off the grid. It's the only way you can really truly isolate your sensitive equipment off the grid is we have a sensor outside that will measure that electrical field that to build up on the ground. And actually, when it goes into the step leader event almost. And so it measures the changes between the atmospheric electrons or measure field up there and the ground field. And when it feels that, senses a certain point and it feels that the lightning is going to strike, what it simply does is just down a fiber optic line from the sensor signals into just a square D contactor through our system, the patented system, and it opens a circuit and actually isolates it by an air gap in the circuit and forces the lightning back into the grounding system.
Now let me ask this question. For a person to install one of these things in their home, and it can protect more things, not just your amateur equipment, you know, but I mean, a lot of us, I mean, I don't know how many folks I've seen have their brand new widescreen TV just destroyed by lightning coming in on the power line. And, you know, and what's weird is today the way circuits operate in a lot of these devices, they stay plugged in and they're actually on all the time. You know, you have a little light, a little LED, a little red light that says, I'm here and I have power, but I'm not operating. You push the button and it comes to life. So the power is coming in. What is a system like that for someone's home? Just ballpark. What does it set them back, dollars and cents wise?
Well, something like that for an in-home purpose. We have other technologies coming up on that, but this particular model would be right around $600, $550 to $600.
What? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I was expecting you to say, well, it would be around $2,000 or $3,000 or something, because it sounds pretty sophisticated, because you have the sensor that goes outside. So you're saying for around $600, a person can protect their home with one of these SensorGuard devices.
You could actually focus on any circuit in your home you wanted to. You could protect. You can actually protect against line surge as well and brownouts and different things, you know, that's hard on equipment as well. So you can set it to that. You can protect against lightning, GPR events, but you can also set against those line surges and brownouts.
That's amazing. I mean, that's an awful lot of technology that's accomplishing an awful lot for a very, very small amount. You know, and I mean, you heard the fellow from Flex Radio. I was glad you were able to sit and listen to him because that gives you a real good example of the mindset and what people are looking at. I mean, I don't know what some of these transceivers that are being sold here at you see from the main manufacturers at Dayton. What's the typical price on these things? I was asking you because what are they going? What top end radios?
You're talking about HF rigs?
Yeah.
Oh, you're probably talking anywhere from $1,500 to $10,000. I mean, it's a pretty big spread.
So it's not uncommon for someone to spend $5,000 on a radio.
No, it's not.
You know, so if you spent $5,000 on a radio, it seems as though you would want to invest at least $600 on a system that would take it off the power grid when a lightning strike comes down.
I can't imagine why you wouldn't.
Yeah. Now, I want to get into this. You've been sitting here a while, but I want to... Youth DX, what is this here? Costa Rica. I was just looking at your cap. I don't know. That's probably got nothing to do with what you do. But this fella here...
Well, we are sponsors of the YDXA, so...
This fella here has got the most amazing phone app. I remember I discovered it. Actually, no. I didn't discover it. My son David discovered it.
Don't blame me.
And he had an Android phone, but then I think... What happened was he got the iPhone, and the app wasn't ready for the iPhone at that time.
Right, it is now, yes.
Okay, and it was almost a deal-breaker on the iPhone. He didn't want to go with the iPhone because he couldn't get the app. You know, but then someone said, we got the app now. Now, this thing, let me tell you what I found, and that is you can go into this app and put a city in.
Really anything. You could put in a place on Earth, the Washington Monument, the Opera House in Sydney, Australia, the Taj Mahal. It doesn't matter. It'll find a location.
Okay, so there are repeaters around the Taj Mahal.
Sure.
Okay. Now, do any of them have the IRLP capabilities or Echolink, do you know? Now, are those AM or FM? Repeaters.
They're pretty much all FM repeaters.
I'm just trying to give this guy a little.
Yeah, I know.
You. The Taj
we do have one AM repeater in New York City.
So if I were standing directly in front of the Sphinx, this thing would get my GPS coordinates, and within a matter of minutes, it would tell me what the local repeaters were in the area that I could actually hit for my HT or my 2-meter. Rate.
That's correct. As long as you have, as long as it's within 90 miles of that point, it'll show you the repeaters. You can override and say, pick any point on Earth and also take a look at the repeaters on that point on Earth. So.
Now, you were telling me about something, and I had to meet someone, I didn't have time to check it out. But you're telling me that somehow, and I don't know who it was, RT Systems, is that who it is?
Yeah, RT, yep.
I don't, I don't even know who they are, but nonetheless, that doesn't matter. There's a lot of things I don't know.
Somehow I doubt that, Ted.
Definitely.
If you had a radio and you're wanting to program in the frequencies in your area, or if you want to program in frequencies to an area that you're traveling to, you were telling me that there's something you can do, and it's just a matter of minutes, and bam, it's done. And it takes it from the database. Talk about this. Tell
all
me
right,
about
sure,
this.
Sure.
Basically, because I'm illiterate, and it's difficult for me to program a radio. I mean, Matt, my son Matt, and Holly have these THF6s, okay? I would think you need an encyclopedia.
You do.
To understand the menus on these things. You know, I have a hard time. Yeah, matter of fact, I got one of these little, what do they call them, the Chinese radio.
A Wuzen?
Okay, you say a Wuzen. Okay, some people say Waxon. I was actually going to start
Waxon, wax off, I don't know, something like that.
I was going to start a contest today and hold the radio up and say, how do you say this, you know, and to see if we could get some. Okay, how would you say it? Let him see your radio.
How do you pronounce that?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I think it's Wuxon.
It's pronounced, oh, boy.
That's what is it? Wuxon, Wuxon, I don't know.
Wuxon?
Chinese radio?
Yeah, I guess so. Something I don't understand, right? Yeah.
Now, what I said yesterday is I said this. If they're going to market a radio to the United States of America, and they're going to put a name on it that nobody can say, then they deserve to be called whatever we come up with.
Hello.
You know, whatever we come up with.
Sure.
Okay.
RT Systems?
Right.
All right.
Let's, yeah, see how
I'm going to wrangle you back in here.
Well, I'm ADD. I may be talking about something totally different here in about 5 seconds. But go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, what we did was we partnered with RT Systems, and we wrote a small software module that allows them to query the worldwide repeater directory. And when I say worldwide, we have over 150 countries in it currently. We have about 32,000 machines worldwide in it, and it's growing. We should have China and Russia shortly. We're a little shy on that, but pretty much the rest of the known world, we've got the repeater data. So basically, you go into the RT system software that runs on Windows, make a query, you put in your user ID and password, and where on earth you want to search for your repeater data. And it'll just go out and find it, and then you just pick the repeaters you want, and it'll write it into the radio for you. And it literally takes 2 minutes. If anybody's ever typed into a grid of something that you're going to program a radio with, you know, it could take hours of research and typing and fixing errors and stuff like that. And
now, does the RT software write to the radio, or does it write to the radio software?
No, RT Systems writes directly to the radio. They have, I think, 90 some odd models of radios that they are able to program, and not just the memories, all the functions. So, for instance, if you had a VX8, and you wanted to make it be an APRS node. The software is capable of doing that without knowing how to flip through the menus, so it's pretty interesting.
We're
very excited to have them attached to our worldwide repeater database.
Yeah, and I was wondering, too, if there wasn't a way, as you're traveling across country, that you could have software that would discover the local repeaters.
Well, we have that on the iPhone and the Android.
I know, but but I mean that would spit that into the radio, so as you're going along down the road, instead of having to program the thing, you just automatically are finding the local repeaters because of the database.
Well, I think you're going to see that more with D-Star because, D-Star, as part of the transmission, includes... We have a little young lady here that just showed up.
Well, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. D-Star is used more and more, D-Star carries the information about the contact, so who the call sign of the call sign of the repeater is, the call sign of the people contacting it and stuff. So as time goes on, we'll be able to use data feeds like that to enhance information even in radios. So
that's just absolutely amazing. This app is called
R Finder, Romeo Foxtrot India November Delta Echo Romeo. R Finder,
it's on the Android phone, it's on the iPhone.
That's correct.
I've got it on mine. The paid app is how much? I don't know, it's not that much.
It's $9.99, and it includes your first year of access to the worldwide repeater directory. Once you have credentials, once you have user ID and password in the phone, you can use that on the web at www.rfinder.net. You can use it in the RT Systems programming software. On Windows, you can use it in Chirp, which is an open source radio programming software that runs on Windows, Linux, and Macintosh.
Now, RT Systems software that they've got that goes into all these different radios, I'm just curious, ballpark, what does that run, or is that open source?
I think it's $49 for a kit, and that includes the cable for the radio and the software, and I think it's around $25 or $30 per radio if you already have a compatible cable for the radio you need to program.
That sounds amazing. I like the app, because even if you aren't set up like that and you're rolling into an area and you want to work or you find out what's going on in your area repeater wise, and there's also a thing on there that you were showing me on, is it IRLP? It shows the status.
Yeah, that's correct. It shows the real-time status of the IRLP node attached to a repeater. So you can actually bring up the repeater detail and touch the number of the IRLP node on the repeater detail, and it'll just show you the real-time status. And that, I think we're the only app that does anything like that for IRLP. We'll have Echolink very shortly. We'll have AllStar very shortly also. So we're constantly enhancing the apps as new voice over IP technologies come out and provide more and more information to the end user.
We've got a young lady that just sat down here. And she's very unusual in the fact that she has an extra class license, and she is 9 years old. Can you get up close to the microphone if you can and talk to us a little bit? So, how long have you had your extra?
About a year.
Okay, and tell the folks your name so that they know who you are.
My name's Michaela Williams.
Okay, and I guess the question I would ask is, what is it that you like about ham radio, and what is it that you like the most, the thing that you wind up wanting to do the most?
Well, I like talking to other people.
Do you do that on HF, or do you do it on VHF? Where do you operate most?
Barbara.
Well, the most I operate is at home, and I got a lot of radios.
You got a lot of radios?
Yes.
What's your favorite radio?
Probably D-Star.
D-Star. Okay. Do you like getting on HF a lot? I mean, talking, you know, distance on.
Yes, I do.
You like doing that. What is the most distant contact that you've made, or the furthest you've talked to someone?
On HF or D-Star?
On HF. Or either one, really. I mean,
that's a good question.
I mean, on D-Star, we believe the farthest has been Australia.
Australia.
HF, I think, is Germany.
Yeah, and HF, we believe, is Germany.
Very, very good. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, it is really, I guess I want to say it's a pleasure talking to you. And you're really an example for other kids to get into ham radio. What would you tell somebody your age about getting into ham radio? How would you encourage them to do that, or how would you go about doing it?
Well, I got into ham radio because of what happened last year in March in Japan with the tsunami. And, I just wanted to be able to help our community if anything like that happened to us.
So you thought by getting the ham license, should we ever get faced with something like a tsunami, that you'd be able to help out communications-wise, get on the air, and be effective in helping other people?
Yes.
Because when normal communications goes down, ham radio is right there.
Yes, sir.
Well, I really appreciate you coming by, and congratulations on having the extra class. And hopefully one of these days I'll get a chance to meet up with you on the air and talk to you sometime.
Yes.
We appreciate you coming by. Now, you're on two international shortwave radio stations. One is just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, WTWW. The other one is in Monticello, Maine. It's on 9330, which is the 31-meter band. And the other one is on 9990, which is the 31-meter band. And basically, the signals are covering the entire world. We're getting emails from New Zealand and all over the place. So a lot of people are listening to you right now. So before you run along, and I know you're surrounded by people here, I know you've got things to do and places to go and people to see, is there anything you'd like to say to all those folks?
Well, hope to hear them on the radio.
Hope to hear them on the radio. Very good. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming by and visiting with us.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's been our pleasure.
All right. Talk to you later. Okay. Bye.
Her call sign, incidentally, it looks like, it's KI4DS. KI4DS. So you have to be...
Kids.
Listening. Yeah, listening for her on the air.
That is awesome.
With an extra class license at 9.
That is
absolutely
awesome.
Amazing.
Sorry.
What do you say after that?
Gosh. I'll tell you what.
I'm done.
I'll tell you what. That was really inspirational.
Tell me, that Youth DX hat you've got on. Now, tell me about that.
In booth 342, the YDXA, they run a D-Expedition every year for kids from 10 to 17, and. You know, we're one of their sponsors. We feel very strongly about supporting kids in amateur radio and getting kids involved. So
That's something that's been a hot button with me. And the reason why is so many times I hear young people get on air, especially on, say, local repeaters, and just get railroaded. I mean, it's like, all these old guys are on air. They don't want to hear these kids on the air, you know. And so I remember the old CQ call the guy used to do, no kids, no lids, no space cadets or something. Do you remember that? You know,
yeah, sure.
I don't know where that came from. I just heard people say it. But, you know, to me, I was listening the other night on I think it was 80 meters, and I heard like two or three kids on one frequency talking. And I like to fell out of my chair, and I was like, "Whoa, this is cool!"
Yeah, we get that actually on the Limark repeater quite a bit in New York City. The 146.850 machine. We have a bunch of different kids that get on, and it's really great to hear them on, and certainly to hear my son W2EEO get on from time to time. That's kind of cool to hear him talking to other kids. So
and he passed, got his ham ticket through Ham Test Online.
He did, actually. Yes, he did.
That's we were talking about that earlier, and we want to mention that right now. We just want to mention the fact that Trans World Antennas and Ham Test Online are our two sponsors for this event. And I do want to tell you that the Trans World Antenna is very, very unusual. If you've not seen this thing, you need to go up to their website, transworldantennas.com. Take a peek at these things because they are very unusual antennas. And I've had some folks say, well, that's a compromised antenna. No, it's not. It's not because it's 10 through 20 meters. You know, it's like a half-wave dipole, but they have arranged it differently. And this thing has a lower takeoff angle than a dipole. It has a lower takeoff angle than an average vertical. And if I didn't own one, I wouldn't be able to say this, but I've played with them to the point now where I realize they're just a very special antenna. What's interesting is they fold up. They go in a carry bag. You can take it with you. It's got a black powder coating on the thing, so it's very durable. And the big thing is they're stealth. They just disappear. You don't see them. We took the one out and tried to take pictures of it. And it was difficult photographing this antenna. We had to set it against a certain kind of background to get it to show up. Because it's just kind of, this is a black powder coating, it just disappears. And we've talked about, well, if you have, you know, in a neighborhood association, you can't put an antenna up. These are the way to go. You can put them on a balcony, you can hang flower pots on it. I mean, you know, nobody will know what it is. They won't know what it is anyways. But they're quite an amazing antenna. They make the 4040, which is a monoband 40 meter antenna, and the 8080. These are the same exact size as the 2010. So go up to their website and check them out. And if you're...
Are they here at the show, Ted?
They are here at the show. They have a booth here. And if...
you know what booth number it is?
I don't know the booth number, but they are here. They are listed if you happen by. They're going to be... They'll be here at the booth with us here, you know, off and on.
So. I'm going to have to find them because my son and I often go and operate in remote locations. We actually just came back from doing a de-expedition at Papa Juliet 4 Sierra in the island of Bonaire.
Oh yeah, that's down in Trans World Radio territory.
Yeah, actually, yeah, we saw the on Bonaire. We saw the transmitting antennas down there. It was really quite a sight to see. They were gigantic.
Yeah, well, you know, they have curtains and
right.
But I remember when I was a kid tuning them in, and they would say from the island of the flamingos, and they'd have the sound effect of these flamingos. This is Trans World Radio. You know, I don't know if they still do that or not.
Well, we drove behind the curtains and looked off the coast through the curtains, and it was really, really quite a sight to see.
I can't see that. Let's get the booth number.
Oh, we got a booth number for Trans World Antennas?
577.
Ah, boot 577.
Okay, I've got a gentleman that's sat down here with us, and he is with the U.S. Navy.
That's right. Hello.
And your name is?
Lieutenant Commander Ed Sylvester.
And tell us a little bit why you're here at the Dayton Hamvention.
Oh, I've been a ham for over 30 years. My passion. Haven't let up since, getting my license in 78. But the reason I'm sitting here today is to promote shortwave radio, because that was my first love. I used to listen to 31 meters quite a bit, and it's especially useful when you're overseas. And I'm about to go overseas again in November, so I plan to listen to your station.
I'm curious, how did you get started, though, as far as your hobby or love for shortwave?
Family influence. I had an uncle. He was the correct generation when it started. I inherited his radio, and I was hooked henceforth.
So how early on did you start listening? What do you think?
I was about 15 years old.
Oh. What do you recall hearing at that point in time?
Oh, gosh. Very crowded at the time. I mean, still crowded, but a lot of powerhouse stations, you know, BBC and Radio Netherlands and... But I especially enjoyed the tropical bands, so 60 meters was my joy. Speaking Spanish, I could understand those kilowatt-powered stations, low-powered stations, intended for local audiences only. So I really had derived a lot of pleasure from that.
Well, I was just mentioning Trans World Radio and their ID, you know, with the Island of the Flamingos.
Right.
You know? And then what was HCJV would do? What was it they would say?
Yeah.
Gosh, it's on the tip of my tongue. HCJV had, they were Quito, Ecuador, but there was something they said on their IDs, and it's gone now. What I used to hear a lot of on shortwave, and I don't know if you remember this, but a country would take, say, the first three or four bars of their national anthem.
Yeah, interval signals.
Yeah. And they would play that and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, and then they would finally start their programming.
Right.
You know, so I guess that was like, you know, calling people to dinner. You know, it was hey, y'all come. We're fixing to broadcast here, you know.
Exactly. And that was how you logged stations. That's how you confirmed stations.
They
still do it.
I haven't heard interval signals in a long time. Matter of fact, I was actually asking George about it. He said, they don't do that anymore. I said, I think some people do.
Oh, yeah.
But when we first started doing a particular program with George, our friend Ronnie Millsap, who's a ham, apt musician, had recorded the first few notes of the Tennessee Waltz for us, and then I used that as an interval signal when we would come on with the radio show.
Right.
And I just those first three or four notes of the Tennessee Waltz, which was really identifiable. I mean, you knew what it was when you heard it, you know. But I remember, I'm trying to think what was, but you know, some of those countries, I mean, you didn't really know what they were. And even when they signed on, you couldn't understand the word they were saying.
Right.
But you begin to recognize that interval coming out at a particular time every day.
Right. And now they maintain the library of interval signals on the internet. So you can query, go to Google and punch in shortwave interval signals, and you'll get a library,
now,
past and present.
Tell me a little bit about your profession in the Navy.
I'm a linguist, and I've traveled quite a bit. I did a lot of communications in the military. You know, so I traveled the world. I always brought a radio with me. If I couldn't bring a transceiver, then I'd bring a good shortwave radio, and I'd always tune in. And HCJB was one of my many targets because they had a really good signal worldwide.
So what does a linguist do in the Navy? What do you, I mean, are you, tell me. I mean, I'm lost now.
Well, I do a lot of interpretation for the embassies. Work a lot with communications. I work as a liaison to foreign navies. That's what I really do.
What languages do you know?
I speak Arabic and I speak Mandarin and Spanish.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm headed to Saudi Arabia in November. And so shortwave's going to be my friend.
Oh, yeah. I imagine it would be. Now, how long has it been since you have been overseas? I mean, when was the last time you were over there listening?
A year ago. I was in Japan. And obviously in Japan, radio is very big, ham radio especially. And they welcome bringing in radios, shortwave radios into the country.
Well, when we were there, you're listening on shortwave. Typically, what signals are you hearing coming, say, for example, the United States?
Well, VOA, obviously, family radio.
They're out of Okeechobee, Florida, I think.
Right, but they have relay stations and Adventist Radio and out of the KTWR, I think. It's Trans World Radio out of Guam. Mm-hmm. And then when I was overseas, I went to Guam and I visited the shortwave stations, and sure enough, they had curtain antennas. And I went to Saipan and saw FEBA, I think, Federal Far East Broadcasting Association, religious
right.
broadcaster. So I've had a lot of shortwave tours. And likewise, every time I go abroad, I try to visit the local shortwave stations. So it's exciting.
Well, if you come to the Nashville area...
Yes, sir.
Are you going to be in our area anytime soon?
No. I've traveled through, but don't have any plans.
If you do, then you come by, and we will give you the tour of WTWW.
Wonderful.
And also, and I know I can say this beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you get anywhere near Monticello, Maine... Uh-huh. Look up Alan Weiner and go see WBCQ.
Okay, yeah, there are quite a few more broadcasters than there were on shortwave these days from the United States, and it's very exciting. Do you guys send QSL cards out?
We do, yes.
Yeah.
And I think Alan does too, but I'm not certain about that. You know?
Wonderful.
Matter of fact, the time, I will say this, we are right now on the air on 9330 courtesy of Rod Hembree and the Good Friends Radio Network. We have traditionally been on 9330 from the Dayton Hamvention every year. And, of course, Rod occupies that space with the Good Friends Radio Network all the time. In other words, that's where he is. That's his home base, and that's where they broadcast 24/7. So they've given up the space for us today. I mean, put us on the air here, matter of fact.
Right.
And that's really cool. And we're also on 9990, which is WTWW.
Well, I just want to extend my appreciation for having me as a guest. My first time ever on shortwave, and it's a thrill because I use the medium for myself, and I enjoy it and have enjoyed it for 35 years, so I appreciate it.
Well, we have the biggest transmitters in the world.
Really? Of course you do. And the best QSL cards, I'm sure.
Well, no, I was going to say, because you know, all these AM-FM stations, they top out at 50,000 watts, you know, and then the FMs, they'll say 100,000 watt FM station, but
right.
really it's only 25 or 30 kilowatts, you know, going
how,
to the...
How powerful is your station?
These stations are 100,000 watts.
Wow,
actual raw RF power going to the antenna.
Now, do you only broadcast in English?
Well, there's different languages that are broadcast on these stations. I would say English is the main language.
Okay. You know. And are you still playing Ronnie Millsap's... the first four bars of his song?
No. That went away a long time ago. But
okay. Well, I look forward to tuning in from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and do that and send us some email. Let us know.
I will do that.
Good talking to you,
likewise.
Sir.
Likewise. Thank you very much. Take care.
Now, I've got two people that just sat down here. We've talked to Caitlin before. And this gal here, I never met you before. Why don't you get up real close to that microphone so we can hear you real good. And Caitlin, you do the same. And tell me your name and your call sign.
All right. Well, this is Anna, W0ANT.
WZeroANT. And tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I got licensed when I was 8. Currently a general, studying my extra.
I see. And just out of curiosity, how did you go about getting your license? What was your study methods and all that sort of thing?
Well, for my tech, I studied on the internet for a couple weeks and then passed 100% in Dayton a few years ago, actually. And then for my general, I mainly did flashcards.
So where do you operate?
I operate pretty much ICOM. I have a lot of antennas. I don't even know their names. I have so many.
Well, get up a little bit closer to the microphone. But I guess I was going to say, what bands do you operate on most?
I do 20, 10, 6 a lot as well. I get on 40 sometimes, 80.
Now, you're operating mostly phone, or do you do any CW at all? Or
I do mostly phone. I'm still trying to get my CW speed up.
Well, that's intimidating because there's so many of these guys that get out and they just, you know, they're like a streak of lightning, you know. They're 20, 30 words a minute and above, you know. So you're kind of like thinking to yourself, do I really want to throw my hat in the ring and get swallowed up in that, you know. But a lot of them will slow down, though. So, I mean, I wouldn't be intimidated if you want to get on the air and do CW. You get on there and go just as slow as you got to go and let them slow down to you. Eventually, your speed, you know, will catch up. Because nobody starts at 30 words a minute. It doesn't happen, okay? So they may be able to do that today, but I guarantee you they didn't do it when they first started. What do you like the most about the hobby? What is it that drew you into it?
Well, actually, I just came down to the radio station once, and my dad was talking to Puerto Rico, and I didn't know what it was, really, and it was just amazing to me that he was just sitting there, didn't even know the guy, and he was talking to him.
Okay, you said the station, you mean his ham station?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm curious, did your dad then, all of a sudden, did he start doing some things that made the materials and stuff available for you to actually get your license? Did he encourage you along at that point? Was the catalyst behind you getting into ham radio?
Oh, well, before I went down in the ham station for the first time, he had told me several times to come down and stuff, but once I went actually down there and started talking, right away I knew I wanted my ham license. So took me 2 weeks to study, and I finally got it.
Ah. So what part of it do you like best? Do you like DX or contesting?
I'm more of a contester. I've won several awards for different contests.
Tell me about those.
Do a lot of multi-singles. I went up to K0RF station once and did a contest with him. Lots of different contests, really.
So you like contesting?
Yeah, and actually recently, last year, me and a few of my friends, we all went down to Costa Rica, and we did DXing for a couple days up there, and that's actually what we're here talking about today.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, do you two know each other?
Oh, yeah. This is Caitlin.
We know Caitlin. Caitlin's been here, sat down with us before, but I just didn't know if the two of you knew each other. So do you ever, let me ask this question. Do you guys ever communicate or talk over ham radio?
This is the first time we met today.
Oh, okay. So you probably will in the future from now on.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah.
Caitlin, you were here, I think you've been here, I think we've talked to you probably twice, it seems to me. How long have you had your ham ticket?
8 years old.
Try it again. Let's see if that works now.
I got my license when I was 8, so I've had my license for about 4 years.
About 4 years. And I know we asked this question probably the last time we spoke, but people are listening today. They probably weren't listening then. So talk a little bit about what you like to do on amateur radio and what your likes and dislikes are, I guess I want to say. Where do you operate the most?
I'm mostly on phone because I'm not very good at all on Morse code, so I sort of stay away from that. So I'm mostly on phone, and I just Yeah, I just wore a rag chew and stuff. I don't really like doing contests and stuff that much. But I'm going to be going down to Costa Rica over the summer, so I bet I'm going to start liking contesting after that. So.
Yeah, I think you have to be thrown into the heat of the contest or into the, you almost have to be thrown into it, you know, and participate in it for a while. And then all of a sudden, I think it's kind of like it gets in your blood, you know. Because the people I know that are contesters, they're like wired, you know. Comes field day, man, all they're wanting is points, you know. And they're up around the clock and going, you know, 24-7 capturing all that, you know. So, what bands do you operate on? What are your favorite bands for just doing rag chewing?
I go on almost all the band, but I prefer 40 meters.
Okay, why do you think you like 40?
I'm not really sure.
One of the things I like about 40 is it's on all the time. In other words, 75 meters during the day, it dries up. 20 meters goes away at night as a rule. But 40, it seems like it's just there all the time. Of course, it changes. You know, I mean, it goes long at night, but at least it's always there. You can always find somebody on 40 meters to talk to. I don't know if that makes any sense. What's your, Anna, what's your take on that?
I don't get on 40 a lot. I don't really. I'm more of a 20-meter person. I like to do a lot of contesting there. I think I've only done one contest where we've had 40 meters, actually.
Well, that was, you know, I guess when I say, you know, but 20 goes away at night. So what do you do if it's 10, 11 o'clock at night and you want to make a CUSO? Where do you go?
Go to sleep.
She just goes to sleep. That's it. It's over with, okay? Well, you know, some of us are night owls. You know, I, of course, 80 comes live at night pretty good. You get pretty good amount of contacts on 80 meters. But like I said, 40 is there all the time. So what would you say to people your age about getting a ticket?
Well, I'd say that, yeah, the smartphones and cell phones and stuff, yeah, they're all awesome. They're there when there's not an emergency. But when everything else fails, amateur radio is there, and you can't get onto your cell phone after a tornado, and then there's no cell phone towers. You just can't. Amateur radio was there after the April 27th tornadoes that struck the southeast United States. Amateur radio was there. After the tornadoes, I was operating net control, like sending out chainsaw crews and stuff. And get. So amateur radio is there. And then amateur radio is also really educational. And then it, like, helps if, like, if you're weak in some subjects, it also helps with that.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed, too, about ham radio is you can generally find on the air people who know about just about anything. You know, I mean, I don't care what kind of information it is. There's somebody out there that you can get on and discuss it with. You know, it's just, it's really quite amazing, you know, to find the people on ham radio that you find on ham radio. And let me say this. Either one of you, did you have, I mean, was there any underlying reason as to why you think you wanted to get a license? In other words, you saw your dad making the contacts and whatnot, and you said, gee, this is something I want to do. And was there a reason, like, hey, I got to get a ham license because?
Well, there was that point as well where during, when college time comes, you know, when you need some scholarships, there's that opportunity as well. With amateur radio, and then really just the general, just everything in general really is awesome. I thought it was cool that, like Caitlin said, when you don't have your cell phone available or your computer, you can just take a radio with you anywhere.
And Caitlin, what about you? Any underlying reason why you said, I've just got to get that ham ticket?
Well, I felt that I needed to get it because like when I was like little, my dad, he would take me out onto like the back porch with his portable station, and then he'd let me operate like a third party, and then after that, I just thought it was fun, and then I just sort of wanted to get it, and then he told me that if all the other communications fail, the amateur radio's there, and then I'm like, I need to get into this, because if our phone quits working or if our computers quit working, I can get onto the radio. Oh, so good. That's why I got into it, and I just thought it was cool, because I'm...
Well, it is cool, and that's exactly right. In other words, you know, things go... You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a cousin of mine who's been in the police department in Montgomery County, Tennessee, and I said to him, I said, well, you know, how effective do you think ham radio really is in an emergency? Now, he's a member of law enforcement, so if anybody's going to be critical, it's going to be him. And he said, oh, boy. He said, sometimes, he said, our stuff just goes down. He's talking about commercial police communications. He said, sometimes it just goes down. And he said, then the only thing we've got are ham operators, hams that come along. And well, I thank you, too, for coming by. I don't want to keep you here because I know you probably want to go out and you probably don't look for boat anchors out in the flea market, though, do you? You don't go looking for those 500-pound transmitters, huh?
No, sir.
Well, that one last question. If you guys go out to the flea market, what are you looking for?
Oh, anything that'll help our Costa Rica friends. And when they go to Costa Rica this summer, I mean, they need lots of different things. They stay with an awesome guy named Keiko, and he, you know, he helps a lot of people. And it's just kind of nice to go down there, you know, because they help you start getting into DX and stuff.
What are you looking for, though? You said things that would help them. What kind of things are they in need of there?
They could always use better radios, lots of handhelds, lots of mics, computers, new software for logging, kind of stuff.
And the organization that's doing that, who is that? Is that?
Well, I think Don started it. I don't know his call. And now we have different people that are the leaders every year, and they take 7 kids down with one of their parents each, and they stay there for 4 days and become the DX, basically.
Very interesting. I was going to say, if there's folks listening and you've got some stuff you want to donate through the project, you know, shoot us an email. You can go up to our website, which is qsoradioshow.com, and there's an email form up there. Shoot us an email, and I will get in touch with Anna here and let them know that you've got some stuff that you think they might be able to use if you've got something so they're looking for computers, looking for better radios, looking for microphones.
Yeah, anything along those lines. Anything can help, even if it's just money.
Just money.
Yeah.
Well, we could make that a priority, though, because I'll tell you what, when things come in, when you're shipping things across the country, sometimes you might think you're helping by shipping, but sometimes the shipping on a big, heavy piece of equipment, you know, is as much as almost purchasing the thing locally. You know, it really can work out like that. However, if you folks are in the need of that kind of stuff, I want to make sure that folks know about it. And if you want to help out what Anna's doing. And now, are you going to Costa Rica?
I went last year. Caitlin's going this year.
So you're
going
to go this year?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so then I know how to get a hold of you guys. So if somebody sends us an email and they want to help out, then we will get a hold of you. And hopefully then you can help expedite this thing. Well, thank you for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You guys stay on track and, you know, do your upgrade to the next license upgrade you were talking about. And you're already an extra, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you're an extra, so you got nowhere to upgrade. You just have to get on the air and do some more rag chewing is what you got to do.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you guys coming by.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
With me is Rick, and how do you pronounce your last name?
Turn my mic up. There, my mic is hot now. WGWW. My name's Rick Rule. We are one-third owners of Ham Radio Deluxe Software. Been in the ham radio business since 1997 with the PAC-TURN, PK-TURN programs. And we are presenting HRD at Dayton Hamvention for the very first time.
I guess the thing I was going to ask you about, and that is, you know, I saw Ham Radio Deluxe some time ago. I remember downloading it, installing it.
Right.
There's all kinds of stuff in it. I mean,
it's the Swiss Army knife of ham radio programs. Simon did a fabulous job, and he did it for 10 years and just got tired. It's a long-winded process to take the
to take it and, you know, continue to do the support for it. And he got interested in the software-defined radio aspect of ham radio. So Mike Carper and I and Randy Gautry, who owns Time Wave Technology, got together and made him an offer. He's still involved to an extent, but we are the three new owners, and we're presenting 5.22 over here at the Dayton Hamvention this year.
Now, for folks that have no idea what Ham Radio Deluxe is or what it can do, let's just start from scratch, the very basics.
Absolutely.
And tell me about the program.
Right. It has radio control built in for almost 150 radios. It has a built-in logbook, which collects DXCC, worked all states, integration with Logbook of the World, the EQSL, an HRD log on the net, spots to DX clusters. We have DM780, which works with the sound card modes. We have everything from CW to RIDI to PSK31. There is a gray line built in, and it's a real live point-to-point mapper to help you work DX. We also have a satellite program that helps you work the birds. So it's really five programs in one. It's kind of like the Microsoft Office for ham radio operators.
Well, tell me something. Now, say the remote control part of it.
Right.
Okay. What all radios will operate with Ham Radio Deluxe?
Any radio that has a CAT interface, computer-aided technology interface. Examples, of course, are everything from the FT840 on the Yaesu side, all the ICOM radios, the 735 to the IC9000. You've got your Flex radios that we support, the Tintec radios, the Kenwood radios, anything that has a CAT port on it that can interface for the radio control. Now, with DM780, if you don't have the radio control, you can even take an old Collins radio or an old Knight kit. I actually was using it with a HW9 just to do CW decoding out of the speaker and using the wind keyer to go into the key jack in the old HW9 to do some QRP stuff. So you're not limited by your radio of what you can do for this. The radio control is totally separate from the digital modes and totally separate from the logbook.
Okay, so but with an old piece of gear, obviously you're not able to change frequencies.
No, you have to do that by hand, but we do have an emulation in there where you can emulate the radio and you can change that emulation to the radio frequency to keep your logbook updated.
Very, very interesting. Okay. Now,
yeah.
In Ham Radio Deluxe, now, how do people handle getting audio to and from their rigs?
If you're doing it in a remote way, the best way to do it is with Skype. I've set up a quadriplegic ham a few weeks ago. He just was going room to room. And so we set up the actual remote settings inside of HRD where you can run your computer control and DM780 and all that from a local PC to your network PC. And then he used Skype to dial in to the remote PC, answered it. We set the logbook up, or I'm sorry, the audio card up to go from the Skype speaker and out to the mic, so you get almost real-time audio going back and forth using Skype and HRD.
I guess the other thing I was going to ask about is, now, if you're set up for doing remote control and you're using Skype in terms of audio,
right?
I guess the things I was wanting to find out is, can you operate CW with...
Sure.
Okay, and so the problem, obviously, if you do a data mode, you could do...
Right. With CW, we have the CW keyers, and, you know, of course, you can just use the typing with a resistor and transistor interface hooked into the back of your radio. So you use remote from DM780. You type into the... type into the chat window, and it'll come out as Morse code. And also, if you want to do ear decoding, that's fine. We do have the CW decoder built in. But most of the CW coders, they only get 70-80%. You still need to know code, know at least your call sign and a 599, and you should be able to make contacts with that. Now, we're introducing something new called Super Sweeper in version 6, which will be out in August. This allows you to, you're familiar, I'm sure, with a CW skimmer from Alex. Well, CW Skimmer decodes multiple CW signals at the same time on the screen and lets you click and go to them. We're going to be able to decode CW signals, RIDI signals, and PSK signals. So say 706T is working CW and RIDI. If you can't get them on CW, you might be able to grab them on RIDI and just with a click of the mouse go back and forth.
Okay, you know, you're talking to a guy here that ran an old Kleinschmidt.
That works.
With a tube-type TU that I built.
Mm-hmm.
So now that, and I haven't done any RIDI since then.
Right.
And it was unreliable at best.
Right.
You know. So, what would I notice today? You want to do RIDI today, you're using a single sideband transceiver. You're using ham radio deluxe. Tell me about the differences now. What would I notice? What would amaze me?
You would find that weak signal RIDI is much more workable because of the DSP that is included into the RIDI decoding. Everybody uses fast Fourier transformations for the engineers out there to do the decoding. That allows us to take to an analog, turn it to a digital signal, filter out noise, filter out any of the other crap, look for the tones, you know, 21, 25, 22, 95, and actually be able to do much better decoding due to the DSP and the fast Fourier transformation interfaces.
Now, Ham Radio Deluxe, I remember you used to be able to download it.
Right.
And at that point in time, it was kind of like a public domain free program.
Well, it was donateware.
Okay.
It was, yeah. Simon would ask for donations, and unfortunately, not a lot of the ham community did support him. And that was very, very disappointing when we found out exactly how much he had gotten from the ham community. And I was just blown away. I couldn't believe that as good a program as it was, that more hams didn't donate to Simon.
Incredible program. Absolutely.
It was amazing, yeah. Mm-hmm. Him and Peter started off, you know, as FT-817 commander. That's where it came from.
Well, how much does it set you back today? If you want to get Ham Radio Deluxe.
Well, let's see. It could set you back as much as $79.95. Now, what we're doing is we're actually on the low end. If you look at DX for Win or Logic 9, those programs just for the logbook is $89.95. $79.95 is going to be what version 6 retails for. HamFest special, and of course, this is on the web also, $59.95 at www.ham-radio-deluxe.com or HRDsoftwareLLC.com, and you can get the $59.95 HamFest special price. But if you're here at the HamFest or listening near the HamFest, come on out. We'll even give you a CD and a handshake and a pat on the back, and you can see all the pretty girls in the booth, too.
Well, okay. A person installs this. How long does it take them to, I guess I want to say, acclimate to the software, to learn the software to where you're actually able to do something with it?
It depends on the person's ability with Microsoft Windows. It's Windows-based software. We've had people that's had it up in 5 minutes. A few hams I've had to, we do telephone and remote support and phone and email support. So I'd have to go into their computer, give them a 10-minute demo, and then they're up and running. But for the average user, I would say within an hour they'd be able to get it up and make contacts on it. Within a few minutes, if they have the correct cables for their radio, doing the radio control. It's just a matter of configuring it, and with the sound card interfaces nowadays, it's fairly straightforward to do that.
Okay, now, when you're coming out of the computer and you're going into the radio.
Right.
And the radio has a cable that goes to it. And
correct.
Now, is this serial or is it USB? How does Ham Radio Deluxe communicate with the radio?
It depends on the manufacturer. Some have USB interfaces that emulate a COM port. Some have a real serial port on the back. Examples of that are the FT450, FT950, 2000. They have a serial port on the back. That goes directly into a serial port. If you have a real serial port on your computer, you can use that. Otherwise, you can use a USB to serial port. Some have built-ins like the Tentec Eagle and the ICOM 9100, 7200, 7410, and 7600 have the sound card and the CAT built into the USB cable built into the radio. So it depends on the way you want to configure it, and that's one of the things that we are able to do is they've been coming by the booth today asking me what cable I need for what, and we'll just hand them the cable, say, here you go, this is what you need. You just need a USB cable, or if you need a CAD interface cable that's a TTL to a serial converter.
I'll say older radios.
Yeah.
Something like the beginning stages. Like I have an old ICOM 746.
Beautiful radio.
Okay.
Now your CI5 interface on the back will work, and then you need something like a rig blaster or a signal link to do the digital audio.
That was what I was going to ask about. I was thinking that... So let me ask you this. Of all the interfaces that are out there, I think it was this last Christmas I got both of my two sons a signal link thing.
Right.
I didn't understand what it was. I just bought it.
Right. Okay.
So... for those types of, now, the signal length things, in other words, these are for the radios that don't have the built-in interfaces.
Well, they don't have a built-in sound card. Everything, the signal link, the Rig Blaster Advantage, all they are is sound cards. That's all they are. They're a USB-based sound card. The interface still has to go. They were used in the old days for TNCs, your 746, and even, like I said, on the old college radios, you'd put audio into the mic jack and you take audio out of the speaker jack. You can still do that with older radios and put it into the sound card and get the decoding and everything. But today, the Signal Link and the Rig Blasters already have ready-made cables for the radios. They can go either in the mic jack or your accessory jack, which is your data jack in the back. And then the cabling goes into the CAT cable interface, which is called the remote on the ICOMs, and usually it's called a CAN interface or a serial interface on the back of the other radios.
Okay, how far back do you have to go? I mean, I want to say where you couldn't utilize, or is this type of control is not available on, like the Kenwood 820s or the 830s?
Right, because they have a dial; they don't have the digital interface. Anything that has a CAN interface for radio control. Let me clarify that for everyone. There are two separate sections to hooking your computer to your radio. There's the CAT control, which is the frequency, mode, volume, RF gain, etc. Then there's the digital modes, which is in Digital Master, which does audio. As long as your radio can do audio one way or the other, like I said, an HW8 still does CW with a key and you've got your audio out. You can actually use DM780, Digital Master, to do CW with those radios. So as long as you don't need frequency and mode control, you can go back as far as even, you know, we won't go up with spark gap, but when we get back to at least a CW, you know, even an old 1940s, 30s, you know, 30s or 40s CW receiver and transmitter, it'll still work with that.
Now, like, for example, a radio going back as far as the ICOM 735.
Yeah, the 735 does have a CAT interface to it. I think the 270 and the 470 were the first ones, and then you had the Kenwoods come in, and then the Yaesus, I think... if I remember right, the 707 was the first one with radio control, but that I can't remember which AC was the very first, but I think it was the 707.
So what about going back to the same time, I think of the Kenwood, the 930S?
Right. TS-930S has the digital display. If it has a CAT interface, then it'll work. But it will work for radio control.
Uh-huh.
But it will still work for digital.
And I don't know if that one has a CAT interface or not.
If it doesn't, you still can use it for the digital modes, CW, RIDI, PSK, Throb, Hellschreiber, etc. So, again, you're just limited by, you're limited for computer control of the radio frequency and mode by the radio. But there is, we've always sent RIDI over the air on the older tube type radios, and since CW, you know, and it's just exactly like having the old radios there, but you're using a key ear and just decoding it through the speaker. It's just really straightforward to do that. And I know people who actually do have Collins. It does work with the Collins.
Well, I would imagine the audio on our Facebook would work with an old Drake. Would
absolutely,
work with, you know,
absolutely,
anything.
Right.
You couldn't change frequencies, so
you can't. No, you still have to turn the dial with your hand, which I still do.
Mm-hmm.
I use the interface mainly for frequency and mode, maybe my filtering, but for the logbook, frequency and mode. So that way, it's easier to get freaks mode, USB upper sideband, lower sideband, so you can chase that paper.
How much of an interest is there right now, though, in remote control operation, where you're taking your notebook, you're logging it at home to your machine, and you are controlling the radio and making contacts through the notebook?
Florida's big, of course. California's big. Anywhere HOAs are big, you're going to have a lot of people with remote stations. That has been the big thing that we've seen. Again, some hams that may have... physical disabilities, and I call them abilities because everybody's able to do it. If they can't get to their radio, they can use the remote to access the radio and still be a ham from their bed. I guarantee you, if I ever get in the hospital, I'm going to make sure that I have my remote with me, and I'll be working CW to the day I die with a remote.
Well, you've got somebody with you here. She's been standing for the duration of this interview. She's shaking her head, indicating she doesn't want to get on the, air.
Right. She's not. She's been around me, and she knows about my radio fetish. Years ago, let me let the listeners know, I actually did morning radio in Atlanta from 1979 to 1986 at WFOM, one of the greatest small market radio stations in the universe. She's been around radio people. She's not a radio person. She understands this, though. And Ted understands exactly what I'm talking about. It never leaves you. It's like a mistress. It's like ham radio. It will never leave you. It's always in your heart and everything. So the broadcasting is always there. She's a great singer. She has this wonderful voice for soprano, and she's got this sweet voice. She is, as Erin Butler, she's our web mistress, and she also does our graphics and ads. So the ads you see in QST and CQ are done by her, and she is an excellent, excellent graphic artist.
Very, very good.
And she is a ham, too. She's a general class ham. And her daughter and her daughter's friend and myself appeared on the November 2010 CQ magazine cover. And her daughter, Victoria, became a general class ham at 11 years old.
Wow.
So we've got a ham family here.
Well, that's cool. I mean, that's just the way it ought to be.
It is. and they love it. Her next youngest, Autumn, is 10. And we said, we need you to wait till you're 10 so you can pass the test, because Victoria was 10. We didn't want to make the other kids upset. But Autumn's coming down, and she's going to start working on hers. And she is a tinkerer. For the Christmas, I bought her one of those Radio Shack electronic project kits like we had. Well, she decided she wanted to start building things on her own. And I think her exact words were, can I build multiple things at the same time? And she said yes. So I think we got somebody else that when I pass away gets the W4PC call right there.
Well, tell me a little bit about your radio career. I mean, now, did you ever do radio engineering, or were you primarily on air, or how did that all happen?
I helped out with engineering. I had a second-class license. I didn't get the first because they put it over to a general, like all of us have. I have worked with phase verticals on a two-finger and a three-finger and a four-finger directional AM station. Some of the stations I've worked at, if you remember in 1979, Dallas, Georgia got a radio station, and they used the call signs of WKRP. I actually have air checks on the Georgia Radio Hall of Fame page from that and from WFOM. But WFOM was the last top 40 station in Atlanta. It ended up closing down in 1983. It always showed up in the top five. Wolfman Jack came there one time for an air shift. A lot of the national jocks, people like Scott Shannon had worked there. Don Rose worked there, and then he went over to WQXI, Quixie. So we had a very, very good radio career in Atlanta, and I never pursued it because about 1986, the corporation started getting in, and they didn't like people to be funny anymore on the air. And if you get up, you know, when you're getting up at 3:30 in the morning, and I'm sure you've done this, it's hard to be funny at 6. And so when you, but you do it, and that's the reason you do it. And I didn't want to be a shut up and play the music kind of guy. So I got, I'd always been into computers. So basically, I'd set up the very first traffic interface for WFOM on an OKPro computer. And so that one thing led to another. And
OKPro,
remember the CPMs? Yeah, CPM. We ran it under CPM.
And those things, they folded up or something.
Yeah, they were luggables. It was like having a suitcase with you. It was a truly portable computer. But we were running CPM and MPM at those days. And what was really interesting was in the WFOM engineering studio was a 1964 radio amateur handbook, which I confiscated after they sold the station, so it's still in my collection.
Well, one thing I found, and I've said this over and over again, that is, the majority of radio stations I have been in,
right,
you go in the engineering room, very seldom now do you find a copy of the NAB Engineering Handbook.
That's correct.
It just isn't there.
Right.
But what you do find are various year editions of the ARRL handbook.
That's right. So, we had an old gauge transmitter, which, you know, we would wire and recircuit and everything like that. And you know how the old gates were. They were just workhorses and everything. And so, you know, we'd put the stand, the 250 watt on the air, and we'd rework some of the issues with the Gates transmitters, put them back on the air. But a lot of the circuits came from the radio amateur handbook.
What power level was the station?
WFOM was a 1,000 watt, believe it or not, 1,000 watt full time on 1230. and it had just enough signal to get Atlanta ADI in it. And so at that time, there were four major rock stations in Atlanta. There was Z93, 94Q, 96 Rock, Quixie AM, and WFOM. Well, there you go. You always had us. We were the old reliable, where if 93, 94, 96 wasn't playing good music, it was at WFOM, and we could be heard all over metro Atlanta.
Well, I had one friend of mine, a friend that I got acquainted with after I worked in Top 40 radio for a while.
You were there, too. Yeah, Hot Hits.
Was Bill Drake.
Yes, I know Bill. Bill's a great guy.
Bill got started at WAK.
AKA in Atlanta. WAKE in Atlanta. Wake. Yeah.
And that thing was only 250 watts.
Yes, it was at that time.
I don't know if it still is, but it was.
No, like, I think it's a kilowatt, but it was a daytime station. Wake was a daytime station.
And it wasn't just him.
Right.
But it was also Paul Drew.
Right, Paul Drew was there.
Mm-hmm. The earphone guy.
Right.
But it's hard to believe the two of those fellows got their start at Wake.
Right.
And where their careers went to after that.
Well, you got Scott Shannon there, Bobby Harper, I'm trying to think of some of the Dr. Don Rose, KFRC, was at Quixie in Atlanta. I mean, you had so many people. Robin Roberts, who's on ESPN, she was in Atlanta Television in those days. Debbie Norville. And I keep calling her Debbie because I knew her as Debbie Norville. She was Channel 11. Atlanta was always a jump point for New York or LA radio. Ryan Seacrest, I didn't know if you knew that, but he got his start at WQXI-FM when it was Star 94. So Ryan started off in Atlanta radio, and now he's king of American Idol and king of Kiss FM in L.A. And he got his start in Atlanta radio. So it's amazing the amount of talent that went through Atlanta in the years that I was there and the years after I got out of there.
Well, Drake, matter of fact, I maintained contact with him up until his death a couple years ago.
Right.
And to be honest with you, he was pretty disgusted with
radio
today.
Yeah.
Broadcast radio today. I mean, he was like, I mean, he was ill from it, you know. And we often wondered. I thought, well, why would he not enter it back into the arena?
Right.
Because he was such a man, a brain, an expert programmer.
Right. Him and Mike Joseph, created Top 40 Radio with Hot Hits, WABC and KHJ, Boss Radio. Bill Drake was Boss Radio, KHJ. And that he was a genius when it came to radio. And him and Mike were the ones in the 80s that created the hot hit formats for the recurrence of rock radio in the 80s. And I think what happened is when the FCC changed the rules to not allow you to own multiple stations in the same market. And a lot of people may not know that. In the old days, you could only own seven stations, and none of them could be in the same market unless they were an AM or FM pair. Now you've got Clear Channel, CBS, Cox, and Cumulus, the four C's as I call them, that own 90% of the radio stations. And they don't want talented people. And it saddens me to see that because I think our generation was the last generation of fun radio, personality radio, breaking stuff out. And now you've got the overproduced stuff. And there's still a lot of rock people out there that want to use the old school stuff rather than doing the auto-tune and all that. So.
Well, the other thing is that as far as the commercial broadcast arena is, we used to be able to endorse products.
Correct.
One thing Drake did not do, though, Drake despised live remotes.
He did not like this.
But back then, I remember CKLW.
Right.
The
greatest Toronto radio station in the world.
Oh, they're actually in Windsor, Detroit.
Windsor, Detroit, yeah.
Chum was in Toronto.
That's right, Chum. Okay, you're correct.
But the problem was is that they had people lined up to advertise.
Right, yeah.
There was not a sales guy that went out calling on clients.
It was all order takers,
Didn't need to, yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing was is product moved. In other words, you'd advertise something on CKLW.
Right.
And you'd empty the store.
Right.
Today, that doesn't happen.
Right. No, it doesn't. And the same thing happened at FOM. We would have revenue. We had Jack Hurst, the great Jack Hurst, who was the Falcons broadcaster. Keep your eye on the ball, Jack Hurst, who passed away a few years back. He was our sales manager and sportscaster. And all it was going out, and you'd visit somebody. They'd sign a work order, and we'd go in. We'd dub the spot, and we're on the air. And, we raised our spots rates based on the ratings and everything, and they were willing to pay it because they knew results. And I don't think you're getting that in today's radio. It's so they don't know, one, they don't know how to do what's called spot sets, and Ted knows what I'm talking about, but they don't know about the top of the hour cumes. They don't know how to keep a listener, and I think that's the problem, is it's too many stuff. And you're also competing with satellite radio and iPods, which we competed with cassette recorders and 8-tracks. and still, you know, it's the same thing. You just, what's the difference? You know, you're playing, if you're at a radio station, you're playing music or you're having fun and playing music. And I think that's the difference.
Well, see, I think the whole thing is this. Radio, back then, mm-hmm. was a companion.
Right.
You flipped the radio on.
Right, and they were your best friend.
And that guy that was on the air was somebody that you heard every day.
Correct.
And he would cut up, he'd have fun.
Right.
And he would talk the ramp of a song and take you right into that song.
Roll and crush, yep.
Put you in the mood for that song.
That's right.
And a lot of times, it could even be a tune that you didn't much care for.
Right.
But if he was into it, and he was talking that thing up.
Right.
And taking you into that record.
Right.
You followed it, and you felt like you were part of that radio show.
Exactly.
The other thing was the presentation was professional.
Absolutely.
In other words, you approached the air audience with a certain type of respect and a level of professionalism. There was none of this like we have today where...
No. You know, it's a morning zoo and everybody's talking and insulting each other, and that's not radio.
The other thing was is that back then, Drake would only allow like a 60-second and then followed by...
A 30, right?
A 30-second commercial.
Right.
Or two 30s back-to-back.
Right.
But never two 60s back-to-back.
No, you never did that. You did.
And now you turn the radio on, and you may get 7-8 commercials back-to-back.
Right.
And there's no one in their right mind's going to sit through that and pay any attention to it.
You've got to do stop sets. And again, we're talking radio shop here, guys. So if you're listening, we're talking shop. If you don't do the stop sets at 8, 18, 38, and 48... you're not going to get the response, because that's when people listen. And Ted knows this too. This is a big secret of radio. You want to win the cume. So you always want to have something hot and something that will keep the listener for the first 5 minutes of that 15-minute spread, because you get credit for the 50 minutes in the cume.
Right.
And
now,
that's the secret of radio.
Now we have the people meter.
Right.
The people meter. And Arbitron is encoding all these things.
Right.
But I was absolutely appalled, because I'm in the Nashville market, and I was appalled at how few people meters there really are.
Right.
And it's like, how can they measure anything based on that few a number?
Right. And I never understood it, because once they got to cumes, cume made sense. You had the diaries and everything, and it made perfect sense. Now, Nashville's a great market. KDF in Nashville, that was one of the best rock stations. Of course, WSIX. So many people came from that. WSM, the king of the Clear Channel. And when I say Clear Channel, I mean 50,000 watt radio station. That's a great market. There are so many good people that came from Nashville. But I've listened to Nashville radio, and then KDF, actually, I don't know if you knew, they changed their format to country. Nashville. Like Nashville needed another country station.
Yeah. Well, I live there, so.
So
it kind of makes you wonder, but that it's supply and demand.
Right.
It used to be that in Nashville, WSM.
Right.
Was not country.
Right. This was years ago. Years and this was before the old.
You would tune in WSM.
Right.
You'd hear Vic Damone.
Right.
You would hear, all the middle of the road.
Right.
I think I've got a popcorn kernel.
That's all right. Go ahead. We clear your popcorn kernel, but I agree. And the old Clear Channel stations, remember the old days of radio, and I'm talking to the guys who used to do the AM broadcast DXing, WKBW in Buffalo with Dick Biondi, Larry Lujak on WLS and WCFL. Charlie Tuna on WMEX, and overnights, and then the Charlie Douglas Road Show on WWL. We're talking real radio people there that they had different formats based on the time of day, the block programming, and at night, you would have listenership that was in the tens of millions, because that was where the Grand Ole Opry started off. They would play, you know, Vic Damone during the day, and then all of a sudden they started broadcasting the Grand Ole Opry, and it just took off. And that's how WSM made itself, with the Grand Ole Opry.
I was going to say the thing about radio stations, like there were radio stations that were not top 40,
right?
That were still classics, like WJR in Detroit,
right, exactly.
WJR had Night Flight on at night. They had, I don't know, they had during the day, they had the Mike Worf Kaleidoscope Show.
Right,
Jimmy Lahn's Afternoons, J.P. McCarthy in the morning.
Right.
They really put out an effort at doing radio. There was a guy on there by the name of Bud Guest.
Yes.
that did all this crazy stuff, you know, and it was really good. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I look now, and I don't know what's happened. I hear WJR has turned into, you know, Dr. Laura and Rush Limbaugh kind of thing. And, I mean, it's just, you know.
The AM 80 radio found its place in talk radio. You know, the AM, I think the AM stereo issues with the FCC in the late 70s did that. Mm-hmm. And, again, a lot of the hams that are listening are BCBDXers. And with all the problem with the Kahn system and the Harris system and all of those and not picking a standard, I think that really hurt AM radio because AM radio could have survived more on a music standpoint. Now, what's taking over radio and actually one of the fun things to listen to, of course, is George Norrie and Coast to Coast AM. You know, and Art did that for years and years. Mm-hmm. And that's the closest you really get to personality and interesting radio now nationwide. You can hear them on some of the Clear Channel stations and such like that.
I was going to say, Coast to Coast, we have one of our very good friends is Linda Moulton Howe. I don't know if you know Linda.
Yeah, sure do.
And Linda, of course, she gets into all this cattle mutilation and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the good
but
stuff.
But it's theater of the mind is what it is.
And that's you know, Red Skelton said that. It was theater of the mind, and you try to make one person laugh, and you can make them laugh for that moment. They may figure out all those problems. And that's where this all comes from. It's entertainment and theater of the mind. Right now, they don't know that I've got three blondes sitting on my lap that are just hugging on me and everything, and they love this old guy, and they're going to go over, and I've got 72 hams in line here to follow me over to the HRD booth, which is booth 108, 109, and 100 in Audio Alley to buy the Ham Radio Deluxe software. So there we go.
I bet you didn't know that, did you?
Did you? Yep, see? You can see them right there. They're there. I mean, you know, and look at it. Oh, my. When did you get Victoria Principal here?
Did you? Have you ever met this gentleman here?
I don't know, Rick Rule.
That's probably you've never met him before.
No,
that's probably a good thing.
Oh, good. Okay. I don't know, a couple old ex radio guys. So, but I'll let you get to him. And again, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ted, for having me on WTWW and WBCQ.
Right, and I need to. I need to get over to your booth and pick up a copy of
Absolutely. Just come on over and we'll do it. And I will end all my broadcasts like I ended them in radio. Have a great day and beam me up, Scotty.
You have a good one. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there. And other information, but go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours, if you wish, And it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Hamtest Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Hamtest Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. Hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Well, I hate to quit when we're having a good time, but that's all the time we've got for this edition of QSO. We invite you to tune in next week, same time, same station, for another broadcast of QSO. And if you're listening by podcast, well, it picks up in the very next episode. Once again, thank you for listening to QSO.